This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And I've been wondering if the Biden White House has been thinking about 1946. Because 1946 was a tough midterm election cycle for Democrats. A year earlier, former VP Harry Truman had taken the reins at the White House after the death of the longest-serving American president, Franklin D. Roosevelt. And it wasn't going well. Heading into the 1946 midterms, President Truman's job approval sank to 33%. And the discontent was driven primarily by American frustration with the economic conditions of the country post-war. Truman wasn't well-liked, the economy was faltering, and the effects in the midterm elections were real. Republicans snatched the House from Democratic control for the first time since 1930. Ending the supermajority which had made possible the late President Roosevelt's ambitious domestic political agenda. I mean, you just have to wonder if the Biden White House is thinking about 1946. I mean, after all, President Biden is also a former VP. And national polls show President Biden with an eerily familiar Truman-esque approval rating in the mid-30s. In 1946, the country was emerging from World War II with a tattered economy. Today, the economic challenges are coming on the heels of a brutal battle against a global pandemic. So you just have to wonder if the Biden White House is thinking about 1946. And if they are, maybe it's worth noting that 2 years after losing the House in the midterm elections, Harry Truman did indeed win re-election. Democrats did retake the House, and the expansion of America's post-war economy in following decades remains the global model of economic power. But you just have to wonder if the Biden White House is thinking about 1946, and if they are, what lessons they're taking from that history. Joining me now is Basil Smigel, a Democratic strategist and director of the public policy program at Hunter College. Thanks for joining us, Basil.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And Maria Teresa Kumar, founding president of Voto Latino. Great to have you with us, Maria Teresa.
It's been too long. How are you?
It has been too long. Basil, I want to come to you on this. What is the White House thinking about these days? I mean, if it is 1946, I'm totally amazed. But what are they thinking about these days?
Well, you know, they're obviously thinking about those approval ratings that you mentioned, and the frustration that really has gone across the country in terms of their inability to get some of their key pieces of legislation done. Look, the infrastructure was done. It's great and it's wonderful, but you know the build better legislation. Climate change was mentioned earlier. There's so many pieces of legislation that are yet to be done, and they must be thinking how vexing it is that essentially one member of the Senate has blocked just about all of their key pieces of legislation in Joe Manchin. That's not just difficult for them to deal with as a White House, particularly Biden, who was a colleague of Manchin's, but also, you know, Democrats across the country are frustrated that the White House can't seem to get around this guy.
So I get it. I get the frustration. But Basil, the president is not on the ballot. And as much as there are these national polls, it's also true that midterm elections are not chosen by a national popular vote. Heck, the president isn't even chosen by a national popular vote. So I guess I'm wondering, I mean, on the one hand, we started in 1946 because there are these important historic trends about a president's party losing seats in the midterms, and you know those approval ratings do sort of track in some important ways. But I guess part of what I'm wondering is, you know, isn't there a strategy here that isn't relying on the White House being at the center, given that this isn't a presidential election year?
Well, that's been a concern of mine for a long time. I go back to, you know, all of these conversations around critical race theory and so on. We can obviously have a long conversation about that. But I think about the fact that, you know, there are almost 14,000 school districts in this country, and that issue is being argued at this hyper-local level. And to me, what Democrats should have been doing all along is fighting these battles at this hyper local level. But, you know, at the same time, Democrats have historically had this cycle to cycle strategy as opposed to this, you know, 10-year, 20-year strategy that the Republicans have had. And the other side of that coin is that, in my view, Biden was not really elected to be a visionary president. He was sort of elected to be a managerial president to sort of get us back to normalcy. So when you combine those two things, that there isn't this extraordinary passion for this particular president among the electorate, particularly among progressives, as well as this sort of inability to have this larger proactive strategy and sort of consistently fighting on defense, what Democrats find themselves, the place that Democrats find themselves today is not only in a defensive posture, but now having to put on the shoulders of the president and members of Congress this task of undoing these extraordinary structural changes that are taking place in our country right now. That is not a midterm strategy. That is a longer strategy.
So as you talk about this longer strategy, Maria Teresa, I do feel like there is at least a part of the Democratic Party that has been thinking not just in cycle to cycle, but thinking across decades. And that is represented in part by Voto Latino and other organizations. I think here also about Steve Phillips, who've been pointing to the dramatic shifting demographic realities in the U.S. and saying, hey, in a decade, in two decades, right, we, in fact, if we're going to vote and move hyper-local, let's move hyper-local with brown and black candidates and voters. Let's think about how we do effective get out the vote. Talk to me about how that sort of long-term strategy is or is not in play in this midterm for mobilizing and turning out Latino and African-American voters.
So I'm glad you brought it up, because I think that right now, you know, it's good that you looked at history to open up the podcast, because we just have to look at history even from 2014, when we saw that the Republicans were ahead in the polls. When the public was asked, who do you want to have control of Congress? They were ahead in the polls of the Democrats by 30 points. Just last week, the New York Times came out with a similar poll, and who would you prefer to control Congress in 2022? And it was 41% Democrats and 40% Republicans. We are in a dead heat. And the reason that we're in a dead heat for who has control of the Congress is because the moment that you put MAGA Republican versus a Democrat, people choose a Democrat. And it's because of all of what MAGA Republicans represent for these communities where we're seeing a multicultural America rise. It is no longer that you have multicultural contests of Americans fighting on the coasts, meaning in Florida, in California, and the East Coast. We're seeing the soul and the fight for the country and the direction we want to go to in the 21st century in places like Georgia, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, in Arizona, and in Texas. And when you look at where the modern day Jim Crow laws are, they're all in these places where there is a booming population of multiculturalism that really scares the Republican extreme right. And that is one of the reasons why I think that these midterms are going to be so much closer, because Americans as a whole recognize that this is not business as usual. They are not going to the polls just to vote on inflation in many cases, as people have predicted. They are going to go and vote whether or not women have agency over their bodies, whether or not their child isn't protected in schools because of there's no ban on assault weapons. They're going to go to the polls because at the same time, they deeply believe that having racism inside their society is making them literally unsafe the moment they go out the door. So this is a very different dynamic.
I want to come to you on this, Maria Teresa, because it seems to me that is the bet, right? That's the all chips in on the table Democrats are doing right now is the notion that far right MAGA Republicans will either, will sort of turn off the electorate. But in a midterm, when partisanship is the defining defining characteristic of voters. And this is like long before the Trump era, right? We just know these are much more polarized, lower turnout elections. I guess I'm wondering, and I'm pretty skeptical of the notion, perhaps because I live in North Carolina, that that MAGA Republicans will inherently turn off Republican voters, either keep them from the polls or send them to the other side of the aisle. And I'm wondering if in fact, actually, it will encourage and mobilize and energize a portion of the electorate, which is typically not going to show up, but would show up in these primaries to vote for very far-right Republicans.
So what we're, again, this is just a polling that we've been doing in battleground states, because our concern is, are Latinos going to stay home? Are young people going to stay home? And to underestimate how closely young women of color in particular holding this idea that abortion is no longer going to be accessible to them is a huge deal. And it's not just about agency over their bodies, but it's also making this calculation that all of a sudden their ability to make decisions for themselves, whether it's to go to school, whether it's to have economic freedom, weighs a lot harder than folks actually realize. I think one of the challenges is that what we're going to see is the administration going to do that final thing? So I think on the abortion issue, it's resonating in a big way. We just came in from the field and found that 68% of Latinos in ruby red states believe in abortion access, to give you an example. I think the bigger challenge, though, is that are they going to follow up on all of their promises? And one of the biggest promises and indicators among young people in particular is, will there be some sort of loan forgiveness coming into September? Because that's something that the president was campaigning on and campaigned really hard on for young people in particular. And so we're looking very closely at the tea leaves. The administration, as of just a few days ago, said that they were asking lenders not to send out invoices for the month of August. Does that mean that they're going to suspend it? We don't know. But I do think that for a lot of Republicans, my guess is that what we're seeing in conversations we're having, and I do think that the Trump fever in some ways are breaking when we see Pence going out and campaigning against the candidates that the former president propped up, or the fact that we see the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post going against Trump, I do think that there's a fever breaking.
Also, I want to come to something Maria Teresa was saying, this idea that the fever is breaking, because I've also been thinking about 1998. It was President Clinton's second term. He'd been under this massive investigation relative to Ken Starr and the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But his approval ratings were at 66%. The Democrats actually gained seats in the House that year, which is, you know, just sort of unheard of in a midterm. And I guess I'm wondering if these January 6 hearings are not breaking the fever, but maybe actually heating it up for Republicans.
Well, that is a concern. There was a lot of earlier polling that suggested that it didn't change minds, that the hearings didn't change minds dramatically among Republicans in recent polling. They've pretty much stuck to their guns, that they may have felt that Donald Trump did, his actions were unethical. A few of them think that it was illegal, but it hasn't necessarily deepened their sort of hate or dislike for the president necessarily. And I think part of the reason for that is that even though the Republicans may not have liked Donald Trump or were particularly happy with a lot of things that he said, he was a means to an end for them with respect to judges, certain pieces of legislation and such. He was a means to an end. And I think the one concern that Democrats have had and should have is that even as they play ads to prop up their preferred Republican candidate in states across the country, like Michigan, for example, that the concern is that we can't just connect those candidates to the far right to being pro-Trump. We also have to continue the arc of that narrative and talk about why the Democrats are better for what voters are experiencing in their lives today. And so that really is the, I think for Democrats right now, the real challenge is just talking about January 6th, is just talking about the attack on our democracy going to be enough. But Maria's right from her earlier points. All of what we've seen coming out of the Supreme Court, all of the challenges to our rights today are extraordinarily motivating factors for Democrats. We just have to make sure that we are doing what Georgia did a couple of years ago, which made them so important to the Biden victory, which was challenge every seat everywhere, something that parties had not been able to do previously. But I think Georgia sort of laid a foundation for that.
Maria Theresa, what is it that Democrats have on their agenda that is better for American lives than Republicans? You know, you started by talking a bit, certainly about reproductive justice, issues of student loans. What, you know, issues don't always show up on the table in midterms, but are there some issues that really could work in this case?
So I think that the realignment that we're seeing in American politics is a flipping of where the battleground states were often considered the Midwest. It's happening very much in the South now. So it is Georgia, it is North Carolina, it is Arizona, it is Texas. And we could park Florida somewhere else for right now. And it's because of this growing community that is diversely young and industry bringing in young professionals. And so in Georgia is a perfect example, and I completely agree that we have to make sure that on the Democratic side, we cannot take any seat for granted, because when you do, you leave opportunity on the table. Just in Georgia, to give you an idea, when you talk about industry, you have the tech industry, you have the entertainment industry, you have farming, you have tech, you have major airline hubs. And as a result, you're bringing in a mixture of professionals that would normally would settle in the Midwest, along with a growing young population of Americans that are incredibly diverse, who are aligned with what we would consider democratic values of, I don't have to convince a young person that climate change is real. They know. I just have to convince them that if they vote on the progressive side for candidates who believe in policy change, that we can actually see daylight. One of the things, though, that we found very striking in the work that we've been doing in the last 18 months since the presidential, a little more than 18 months now, is the fact that a lot of young people in particular can't tell you the difference between the Republican and Democratic Party. They think that it's kind of all a wash. And that speaks to the inability of the Democratic Party to communicate what they have accomplished in such a short period under Biden. We went into the field again and started explaining with people that are from the local communities, explaining that under the Democrats, they passed the child tax credit, that the infrastructure bill was passed, that the COVID relief packages came from them. And they were surprisingly not only engaged, but we were able to help them, you know, understand the difference between the two parties. And so unlike the Republicans, who, when you say build that wall, whether you like it or not, you know exactly what they stand for, there's still not an understanding of what the Democrats stand for.
We have just a minute, but Basil, we talked about messaging here. What about structures? What is DCCC and DNC actually doing to inject resources into these elections?
Well, they do have some independent expenditures up and running to really fund a lot of those ads that I mentioned earlier, which are the sort of ads connecting the Republican candidates around the country to Trump and to the far right. So I do think that kind of infrastructure is in place and operating well. The concern that I've always had, and this is coming from somebody who used to run a state party, that for a number of years, particularly during those Obama years, the state parties just did not have the financing, the resources, the infrastructure to elect the candidates down ballot. And it's something that I talk about all the time. State and local elections are so incredibly important. And that's one of the things that we need to really push with our young people, not just to support the party apparatus, but to support those local elections.
Basil Smichel is a Democratic strategist and director of the public policy program at Hunter College. And Maria Teresa Kumar is Voto Latino's founding president. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.